Today my visitor is Father Merv Duffy. Father Merv, a warm welcome at Haida Mai to our radio station.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Father Merv is a Maurist priest with a doctorate in systematic theology, and he is a lecturer in theology and dean of studies at Good Shepherd College in Auckland. Father Merv is one of our presenters at the Mercy Spirituality Center for our Year of Unfolding, as we call it. Father Merv, last year in our Year of Roots, you gave a talk at our center explaining the history of the true vine. Could you please tell those of our listeners who didn't make it to your talk what the true vine is?
It's a poster, a visual aid, which was used by Bishop Pompalia and the first Catholic missionaries as they preached to the Maori in the late 1830s about what the Catholic Church was like.
So what was on the picture?
A vine or a tree rooted in Christ. It actually had the crucifix at the root and growing up, and the branches were the missions of Christ, of the apostles. And so each branch was a place, each fruit was a person or a diocese or such things. So it was a summary of church history from a mission perspective.
And when you showed us that picture of that genealogy, the vine, you pointed out certain handwritten figures that looked like dates. Can you tell us more about the importance of these figures?
I was interested in studying how the poster had been used, so any additions or changes to it were very significant. Alongside of the trunk of the vine was printed the names of the ecumenical councils, but handwritten, and apparently in the handwriting of Pompalia, alongside them were numbers, which I initially thought were dates, but eventually worked out were the attendance figures of the bishops at the ecumenical councils.
And so these attendance figures, they are important for the Maori?
I wouldn't have thought so. If I was preaching to Maori in the 1830s, I don't know that they would want to know exactly how many bishops attended the Council of Nicaea. But if I'd been Bishop Pompalia, whose claim to fame, partly against the Protestant missionaries at the time, was that he was a Catholic bishop. And so he's telling them he's a bishop, and the followers of because the word missionary meant the Protestant missionaries. So the followers of the Catholic bishop were called the followers of the Episcopo, which is a Maori transliteration of Episcopus, the Latin title for bishop. So he was stressing that he was a bishop, and he was out to explain to them who the bishops were. And so that the bishops gather in council to guide the church was part of his explanation of who he was.
So it was like the bishop was like a chief then? He maybe may have explained
much.
It like that. And the more chiefs, the more important you are.
Yes, and one of the things that happened with Pompalia's preaching was the Maori realized that he was a high-status individual. And in quite a stratified Maori society, where there are sub-chiefs and chiefs and greater tribes and less, and where they'd had stories from Europe about people who dressed in amazing fashion and all this sort of thing, the first churchman who in some way lived up to these stories was Pompalia. And so they thought he was a chief, and that the priests who came out with him were his warriors, and that the brothers who were with them were their slaves. So there's problems with the hierarchical view as well.
But he could trace back all the way back to Jesus.
He recited the genealogy of the church, going through the list of popes as the genealogy. And for Maori, who customarily begin a presentation with a whakapapa, identifying who they are and where they belong, and usually how they connect to their audience, what Pompalia had lucked into was an approach that made perfect sense to Maori.
So it's like the Maorist, the English missionaries who came and who were Anglicans, they might not have had this idea of tracing back all the way to Jesus. So if you have two sorts of missionaries and one can trace back to the main person, do you think that it's a way to attract the Maori at that time?
Oh, very much, because they were quite conscious that they were arriving second. And Catholics aren't used to being the second missionaries into an area. We're used to being the older church, the earlier church. But in the Pacific, the French Revolution was on, the Catholic Church had all sorts of problems, and English and Wesleyan missionaries evangelized the Pacific well ahead of us. So Catholics were Johnny-come-latelys, and Pompilia was keen to explain that his was the mother church, the true church, the trunk church, that these later churches were broken branches that had come off from the main trunk.
Broken branches.
Oh, yes, and he, on his diagram, he even had them falling down into the fire. And one of the interesting things of the change made to this chart is that the fire was covered over. He softened his approach to other Christian churches based on his experience of preaching in New Zealand.
So can it be that it, because at the beginning it was the time of just after Waterloo, the French had been defeated, and so he had to...
The French certainly didn't like the English then.
But then he was more moderate, so he painted it. So, or somebody else.
Yes.
How accurate do you think that the research on the true wine can be considered?
Oh, that's a I'm the researcher here. this is an attack on. No, New Zealand history is quite recent. And we've got good sources, and it's well documented. And we have letters from the time, for example. And we have material like this in the hand of Pompilia, where we can be reasonably sure of his motivations. But any time you're dealing with history, it's very hard to prove something in the past.
Yeah, and you have to have different stories. That's what history means.
And there will be different readings.
Yes. For those of you who have just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or send me an email at muffintalk840@gmail.com. My visitor today is Father Merv Duffy. Father Merv is a Marist priest and lecturer in theology and dean of studies at Good Shepherd College in Auckland. He has been telling us about the roots of Catholicism in New Zealand and the genealogy, the true vine that Bishop Pompalier used in order to explain more about the Catholic Church to the Maori, the first people on the land. Father Merv, on the 23rd of February, you are going to give a talk on the evolution of the crucifix. Now, you just mentioned that a crucifix was on the bottom of this of the drawing of the true vine. But also you were talking about the Catholic Methodist cooperation last year. Isn't the crucifix one of the very Catholic symbols?
Yes, very much so. Just to define it, a crucifix is the cross with the figure of Christ upon it. So it has a corpus, it has a body. So people distinguish between simply the cross and a crucifix. And the empty cross is often taken as a resurrection symbol because Christ has risen. When churches split, they tend to differentiate themselves symbolically. And most churches that emerged from the Reformation adopted the resurrection cross, the cross without the corpus.
And are there other Christian denominations that also use the crucifix with a body on the cross?
The Catholic practice is linked very much with the Orthodox practice. So both Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox use a crucifix, but they shape it slightly differently. They often have slightly different symbols in it. So it's a crucifix, but they are differentiating it as an Orthodox crucifix from a Latin crucifix. The churches of the Reformation are not totally united in this. You actually showed me some examples of Lutheran churches who maintained the use of the crucifix. You'll see crucifixes in Anglican churches. Anglican churches tend to vary from high, who'll have very Catholic symbols, down to low Anglican churches, which will be more evangelical. At the evangelical end, it's much less likely that you'd see a crucifix.
And you just mentioned the Orthodox churches. What are the differences? You said the shape of the body of Jesus?
It is something to do with the shape of the body of Jesus, but, for example, there is usually a foot plate on an Orthodox crucifix. So as well as the crossbar where the arms are nailed, they'll have a crossbar where the title, the sign on the cross is, and at the base and angled, there will be a foot plate where the feet of Jesus were nailed. We don't know whether historically this existed or did not exist, but in the Orthodox artistic tradition, the cross, you get the single upright with three lines going across it.
And sometimes Jesus' feet are one on top of the other, and sometimes they are next to each other. Does that have a meaning?
Now you're onto something deep and that is going to be mentioned in my talk. For about the first 1,000 years, Jesus' feet were side by side and nailed with two nails, which tended to give a much more upright posture to the figure on the cross, and frequently an alive Jesus, not apparently suffering, would be looking from the cross at you with his feet, almost as if he's standing there with his feet down. Once, and this is very much from the time of Francis of Assisi, once they go from a four-nail crucifixion to a three-nail crucifixion, the feet are nailed together, which makes automatically the posture more tortured, and you're more likely to have a dead Christ or a very clearly suffering Christ than, for example, a Christ the King-type presentation.
So the three, is it because of the holy number of three?
Any time three comes up, it gets given significance. So three nails will be a symbol. And for example, if you see the Jesuit logo, you'll see the three nails on that. So that becomes a symbol of the crucifixion. But there's the five wounds of Christ. There's various numbers that get associated with the suffering and death of Jesus.
And the shape of the cross, when you see different crosses, would you see this is an Orthodox cross or this is a Roman Catholic cross?
Very much. You can identify the type of cross by its shape. The Latin cross, the Greek cross, the Maltese cross. The cross has been used so widely and in so many different ways. There is an extraordinary number of variations. You know, if you put it on three steps going up with a skull at the bottom, you have a Calvary cross because it's recording the place. Jesus was crucified at the place of the skull.
And some people say that the crucifixes symbolize Jesus suffering at the cross. Whereas we should see the empty cross as a symbol of the resurrection. Like you mentioned before, the Protestants often say we have to see the cross without Jesus because it's resurrected.
Mm.
But then there are others who said we shouldn't have images of Jesus at all, especially when worshiping. What do you think?
That Jesus is risen? Yes, I think that. That Jesus did suffer and die for us, I think that also, so that both the death and the resurrection of Jesus are very, very important. And the issue of images of the Lord has been fought twice in the history of the church in the great iconoclast controversies of the 600s and of the 1500s. And I and the Catholic Church basically side with St. John of Damascus, who argued that the incarnation allows us to have images of Jesus because what was taken as being against the first commandment, to have no representations of God, so therefore you shouldn't have images. Jesus Christ came in the flesh, therefore, and showed us the Father. So the the first icon of God is Jesus, because in the flesh we see in him the Father. Because he came, we can now have representations of him, which therefore show us what God is like. And every crucifix is an icon, is an image of Christ, and it's an image of his saving death. And that God sent his only Son to die for us is the most important thing. And it's interesting, as an artwork, there are more crucifixes than any other artwork in the world. I have several crucifixes. I don't know how many. And like every rosary has a crucifix on it. And like most Catholics, I've got a few of those, which I can never find when I need them. And there are, you know, 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, each of them with several crucifixes. There are more crucifixes than any other art form. It is, in one sense, by its sheer number, it's the most important artwork in the world.
It is distributed all over in the world, and everybody knows that it's a symbol for the Christians.
Yes.
And in our Roman Catholic Church, there's usually the practice that crucifix has to be close to the altar. But also in other parts of the church, is this a requirement?
In the Latin rite, there is the requirement that there be a cross in the sanctuary. And the interesting thing is the instruction and the general instruction is for a cross. It doesn't actually say a crucifix. And so in some places they use the procession cross, which they set up in the sanctuary once they've arrived. And so what is there does not actually have to have a corpus on it. But most frequently we have a large sanctuary cross, a crucifix. But you get painted icon-style crucifixes. You have sort of resurrection crucifixes, Christ the King-type arrangements. The range and variety that exists within the Roman Catholic Church is enormous. And other churches use different symbols, or again, because of that iconoclastic element of the Reformation, some Christian churches try to be as plain and simple as possible so that there's nothing between you and God. Whereas Catholics tend to go in for holy things, holy places, and holy symbols, because we want, and holy intercessors, because we want every help we can get to get to God, because we're not beings of pure spirit. We want bodily things. We want things we can touch.
And is it when the priests celebrate Mass, they have a crucifix usually on the altar? Is that right?
That's something which has actually arisen more in recent times because of the influence of Pope Benedict. Pope Benedict has great devotion to the sacrifice of the Mass and the idea that the priest should be looking at the sanctuary cross. And the way the cross is in most sanctuaries with the dialogue Mass with the priest facing the people, a lot of times the main crucifix is behind him. So you would see in papal masses with Pope Benedict, he would have a cross standing in front, directed at the celebrant, not at the congregation, because he wants the priest to be aware that it's not him doing this, that this is the sacrifice of Christ, that the liturgy is the work of Christ. And so this Benedictine arrangement of the altar, I actually wonder sometimes the shyness of Pope Benedict was also part of why he sort of erected almost this fence of candles and crucifix. Yes, he's hiding behind it, partly because he doesn't want a cult of personality, or he doesn't want a priest that gets in the way of the liturgy.
And so in that case, you'd have the priest having his little crucifix, and yes, then the congregation has the big crucifix behind the priest.
Yes.
But there's always a crucifix you celebrate Mass, and there's always a crucifix in the church.
Because there is one sacrifice, which is the sacrifice of Christ.
Did the first Christians also have a cross already?
this is where it gets interesting. The answer, the short answer is no. While people were still being crucified, it would have been garish and gory and horrible to depict the crucifixion. So the our very earliest Christians, A, seem to be part of a Jewish culture that doesn't use much by way of pictures. So they use words. And then the closest thing to a crucifix we get is when the letters chi, which looks like an X, and rho, which looks like a P, are put one atop the other. And that is the start of what is going to become the crucifix. And it's not until Constantine, the emperor, outlawed crucifixion. And this is, he's the running the Roman Empire, and out of respect for Jesus, he says that nobody is to be crucified. He still kills people, you know, executes them in all sorts of ways, but no longer by crucifixion, out of respect for the Lord. And once that happens, and it recedes enough into the past to not be public execution, then the symbol is available. But there's almost a shyness about the crucifix, and it takes time to emerge as a positive Christian symbol, because there's a real judo throw going on here, because that Jesus suffered and died is a scandal, as St. Paul points out, the scandal of the cross. And one of our earliest artistic depictions of the crucifixion is in fact a mockery done by a soldier in a barracks who scribed, this is called the Alexamenos Graffito from the Palatine Hill in Rome, and he scribed a picture of presumably a fellow soldier whom he wanted to mock, Alexamenos, an Egyptian name, and he drew him in the Egyptian posture of worship, a bit like dance like an Egyptian, towards a figure. Now, a naked figure on a cross with a donkey's head. So this is a mockery. You know, Alexamenos obviously follows this strange religion whose God, rather than being powerful or anything, whose God got crucified. What a hilarious religion.
I once read something about the Celtic crosses, that there were Celtic crosses that are way older than Christianity.
Depends what. Well, dating Celtic crosses is very hard, because the Celts basically took stone that was sitting there and carved patterns in it. So how you date a piece of rock is very hard, and how do you prove when somebody excised this pattern into it? And what I'd be interested, because this the Celts and their artwork with their intertwining figures and the patterns involved, it's strong and distinctive, and it certainly has elements that predate Christianity. But one of the things about Ireland as the Celtic centre is that it became an enormously Christian place, and they would have picked up pagan elements and incorporated them into their imagery, and they do. There's wonderful beasts going up Celtic crosses, and there's these amazing knot patterns, because it's not like Christianity has its own unique set of symbols, whereupon you had the world going along, and then Jesus came along and gave this colouring book or this picture book to his apostles and said, you're only to use what's in that book. No, what he did was he baptized pagans. And the pagans come in with their skills and their ideas and their art. And so many pagan symbols get baptized into the Christian symbols.
It's the early inculturation.
Absolutely.
And I remember even today the cross is still in discussion, because in Bavaria, where I come from, there were, for years and years, there have been discussions on the crucifix debates is it okay to have a crucifix in the classroom? Because most of the schools are public schools, but yet, as it's a Christian state, so we all have crucifixes in the classes. With more and more atheists and other religions, there are more and more people saying we don't want to have a crucifix.
This is one of the issues for a multi-faith society, even wishing people happy Christmas and whether there should be cribs around at Christmas time, which in New Zealand used to be something that would be state-sponsored and town councils would organize. And it was normal in a Christian culture for Christian symbols to be presented. And it is interesting that in Bavaria, where you have got both Lutherans and Catholics, the cross was an acceptable symbol. A crucifix was probably acceptable because Luther didn't really object to the crucifix. But once your society becomes more pluralistic, in a state-funded organization, should there be symbols that speak to one part of the society, but maybe symbols of oppression for other parts of the society? And the interesting thing is the religious groups generally are quite happy with other religious symbols. Most Muslims are not offended by the presence of a crucifix because they know, as a minority religion within the culture, that if religion is pushed out of the public sphere, then Islam, which also wants to have its place in the public sphere, would be likely to get pushed out. But there are atheists and a fairly militant form of agnostic who don't want any religious symbols with any kind of state sponsorship, and they want religion made private. So it's all right for me in my own room to have a crucifix, but if there was one at the top of Mount Eden or wherever, that would be opposed.
And if I think back to Bishop Pompalier, he came after the French Revolution, and exactly what you were saying now with the separation of state and religion, that was one of the big issues during the French Revolution.
Yes, and New Zealand is one of the first countries to decide not to have a state religion. So there is not a state church in New Zealand, although the Anglican Church is the church that had the closest to that status within New Zealand. But the parliament that decided not to have a state religion, trying to avoid the religious wars of the past, also chose to open with a prayer. And it's interesting, there was an attempt to rewrite the prayer relatively recently, and elements of Maori spirituality are among what it is acceptable to do in New Zealand in public society. So we have blessings, we have karakia at dawn, and it's because of the religiosity of the Maori people rather than of the country.
Maybe we don't have a state religion here also because of the Treaty of Waitangi. As the Treaty of Waitangi comes up now, I think it's one way of thinking of it, and the role Bishop Pompalier might have played in that treaty. I'm sure that your talk will be really fascinating on the 23rd of February, and it's from 10 o'clock to noon at our Mercy Spirituality Center. And on the 3rd of March, we are going to start a series of talks about mysticism. So we are also going in that direction. We have Jewish mysticism, Sufism, the Islamic mysticism, and we have Christian mysticism. All three evening talks will be Kuha talks, and it's on the 3rd, the 10th, and the 17th of March. But please register with us.
When you say Kuha talks, you mean people are invited to give a donation.
Yes. And so please register at 09 for Auckland, 638-6238, or through our website at www.mercyspiritualitycentre.org.nz. And I thank very much to Father Murph for coming to our studio here today. And I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless.